in abundance, sufficient for the luxury and convenience of the people in Germany.
Jeffrey's show.
And welcome to the Donald Jeffrey Show. I'm Donald Jeffries. My special guest today is John Armstrong. I've been wanting to talk to him for a long time and really admire his work. If you're familiar with Harvey and Lee, I'm sure most of you are. You associate his name with that. It's an incredible amount of research went into that. So because there's so much research, so many names, so many dates, we really can't even begin to cover it adequately in an hour. So he's going to focus on a particular aspect of it, which is fascinating enough. And hopefully those of you who haven't had a chance to check it all out will buy his book or go to harveyandlee.net. And he also has in Baylor University, he has a John Armstrong collection there. The URL for that is really long. So I suggest you just do a search for John Armstrong collection at Baylor University, and you can check out all his papers there. But tonight he's going to, again, discuss a particular part of that. It's going to be him talking mostly. I may interject here or there, but John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So begin where you want to begin, because we're going to talk about, you know, I want you to be able to go over the material you want to go over. So I think you're going to be describing the pretty much the early years of Lee Harvey Oswald, like 1945 to 1956.
Yes.
Okay, well, you can go ahead and start whenever you're ready.
Okay. Well, as most of us know, Lee Harvey Oswald was born in New Orleans on October 18, 1939, to Robert E. Lee Oswald and Marguerite Clavery. Oswald's father died shortly before his birth, and left his wife with three children, stepson John Pick and sons Robert and Lee. In 1964, Warren Commission attorneys Albert Jenner and John Eli questioned 31-year-old John Pick about different home addresses where the family lived in New Orleans. Pick, who was 12 years old in 1944, was asked about 10 different addresses for Margaret Oswald during a two-year period. Pick recalled only two of these addresses. This was the beginning of many unexplained addresses for Margaret Oswald during the next 20 years. In June 1944, Margaret Oswald left New Orleans and moved into a home she'd purchased in Dallas, Texas at 4801 Victor Street. In the spring of 1945, Margaret's close friend of many, many years, Myrtle Evans from New Orleans, visited her in Dallas for 1 week. Myrtle and her husband, Julian, remembered Marguerite, quote, as a beautiful woman with black hair, a real fashion plate who dressed beautifully. On May 7, 1945, the tall, nice-looking Marguerite married Edwin Ekdahl in Rockwall County, Texas. A month later, Marguerite sold her house at 4801 Victor and moved into Ekdahl's home on Granbury Road in Benbrook, a small suburb adjacent to Fort Worth. In September 1945, Robert Oswald said the family drove in Ekdahl's car from Dallas to Port Gibson, Mississippi, where Robert and John entered the Chamberlain Hunt Military Academy. Robert then told the FBI that his mother, Ekdahl and Lee, drove to Boston. Now, it appears from school records that the family returned to Benbrook in October because Lee entered Mrs. Ella Russell's first grade class at the Benbrook Common School on October 31st. He is present 82 days and absent 15 days. In May 1946, after experiencing marital difficulties, Marguerite took Ekdahl's car and together with Lee drove to Covington, Louisiana. She rented an apartment from Mrs. Logan Magruder, who told the FBI that Marguerite rented from her for about a year. On September 19, 1946, Lee enrolled in Miss Hester Burns' first grade class in the Covington Grammar School. 3 months later, the Oswald family spent Christmas holidays in New Orleans. While the Oswald family was living in Covington, Louisiana, Mr. Ekdahl's whereabouts are unknown. By the end of 1946, Ekdahl had rented an apartment at 1505 8th Avenue in Fort Worth, and apparently was living there with another woman. A month later, in January, Margaret and Ekdahl ended their 8-month separation and decided to reunite. Lee left Covington with a note moving to Texas. Margaret and Lee returned to Fort Worth, moved into Ekdahl's apartment on 8th Avenue. 7-year-old Lee was enrolled at nearby Lily Clayton Elementary on January 27th in Lois Lorimore's first grade class. Now, while talking to a neighbor, Marguerite learned that a woman had been living with Ekdahl while she was living in Covington, Louisiana. On February 1st, 1947, she confronted Ekdahl, accused him of infidelity, and during the following months, they argued continuously. On May 30th, Lee Oswald completed the first grade. His two older brothers returned to Fort Worth from Chamberlain Hunt Military Academy. John Pick told the Warren Commission that he got a summer job at the Tex Gold Ice Cream Parlor 5 blocks south of their apartment and was soon promoted to assistant manager. Now, Marguerite, John Pick, Robert, and Lee, living at 1505 8th Avenue in Fort Worth in the summer and fall of 1947, as we shall see, is very important. Now, one little note on Ekdahl. Following the assassination of President Kennedy, the FBI conducted a background search on Edwin Ekdahl. Their report states, quote, records do not indicate where Ekdahl worked from 1943 to 1953. The company, Abasco Services, will not be able to furnish this information. This lack of information has caused many researchers to wonder and speculate as to Ekdahl's involvement with the Oswald family. Now, I'm going to interject a side comment here that has to do with refugees after World War II. Frank Wisner was a Wall Street lawyer and during World War II worked for the Office of Strategic Services, predecessor of the CIA. After World War II ended, thousands of Eastern European refugees were brought to the United States under his supervision. National Security Council records show that Wisner, the CIA director of clandestine operations, oversaw the relocation of thousands of anti-communist exiles to the United States as a means of rewarding them for conducting secret operations against the Soviets. Wisner became the CIA and State Department's expert on European war refugees and secretly subsidized the refugee relief organizations that brought these Eastern Bloc refugees to the United States throughout the 1940s and early 1950s. Wisner and his group recognized they could use these Eastern European immigrants' knowledge, customs, and familiarity with their respective homelands. Wisner asked the National Security Council to sanction the systematic use of such refugees, and they agreed. The NSC soon issued Top Secret Intelligence Directive No. 14, which today remains classified, that authorized both the FBI and the CIA to find and jointly exploit the knowledge, experience, and talents of well over 200,000 Eastern European refugees resettled in the United States. The CIA soon contacted the Displaced Persons Commission, which worked closely with the leaders of refugee organizations. Chairman Hugo Ossari sent a memorandum to all refugee organizations in the USA that read, "We would like to advise that the U.S. Commission has a formal agreement with the CIA to cooperate in every possible way to facilitate their programs. It is therefore altogether desirable that local representatives of the voluntary agencies and state commissions and committees make available to fully identified CIA agents the addresses of displaced persons." FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover now had the authority and means by which to contact Eastern European refugees and use them to help identify communists living in the United States and alert the Bureau about potential terrorist plots against America. The CIA, however, had broader and more ambitious plans. The CIA's Office of Clandestine Services under Frank Wisner was running hundreds of covert projects, most of them government documents authorizing the use of refugee organizations to help intelligence agencies remain secret until the 1990s when they were declassified. Some still remain secret after more than 60 years. and many of the documents had been destroyed. Many of the Eastern European refugees were settled in and around New York City, where they learned to speak English and continued their propaganda efforts against the Soviet Union with help from the CIA. I believe that one of these refugees, a young boy, was given the name Harvey Oswald, and along with his caretaker, a woman who was given the name Marguerite Oswald, may have been subjects of a CIA security file. In January 1953, the House on Un-American Activities in New York had a file on a Marguerite Oswald. This file contained references to 1941, Nazis, New Jersey, and was eventually discovered in a CIA Office of Security file. In 1995, the Assassination Records Review Board requested this file, which obviously contained information related to a Marguerite Oswald, but their request was denied. Following the assassination of President Kennedy, a Mrs. Jack Tippett of Westport, Connecticut, telephoned the FBI. She said she just received a phone call from an unknown foreign woman who asked if she, Mrs. Tippett, was related to police officer J.D. Tippett, who was killed in Dallas. The unknown foreign woman said that she knew Oswald's father and uncle, who were from Hungary, said they used to live near 77th and 2nd Avenue in Yorkville, New York City, were unemployed, and spent all of their time on communist activities. The unknown woman could not possibly have known Lee Oswald's father, Robert Edward Lee Oswald, because he died in 1939 in New Orleans, 2 months before Lee Oswald was born. But she could have known Harvey Oswald's father, who she said was from Hungary and lived near 77th and 2nd Avenue in Yorkville, where many Eastern European refugees were then living. We should remember Dr. Renatus Hartog's description of Harvey Oswald while at the youth house. Hartog said, quote, he, 13-year-old Harvey, had an underfed look reminiscent of the starved children I had seen in concentration camps at the end of World War II. If Harvey's father and uncle were from Hungary, it is likely that Oswald's native language was Hungarian and or possibly Russian. After the Soviet Union annexed the Eastern Bloc countries, those countries were required to teach the Russian language in all schools. This would explain Harvey Oswald's proficiency in the Russian language, his ability to pass a Russian language exam at age 19, and his familiarity with communism. While young Lee Oswald, a U.S. citizen born in Louisiana in 1939, was chosen to share his identity with Harvey Oswald is unknown. In the author's opinion, the secret covert plan for two young boys to share the same identity began either when Marguerite Oswald was working for the Navy in World War II or during her relationship marriage to Edwin Ekdahl, perhaps both. This was the beginning of the CIA's Oswald Project, codenamed RX-ZIM, Z-I-M. This project was created for the purpose of merging the identities of young foreign-speaking people from Eastern Bloc countries with American youths of similar age. The foreign-speaking youths would learn English while living in the United States and, when young adults, act as interpreters and translators of their native language. If recruited and trained by the military or a U.S. intelligence agency, these young adults could then return to their home countries and spy on behalf of the United States. Now, let's return to Lee Oswald and his mother in Fort Worth in 1947. In the summer of 1947, Marguerite Claverty Ekdahl and her son Lee were living in the upstairs apartment at 1505 8th Avenue in Fort Worth. It's worth mentioning that the short, heavy-set Marguerite Oswald imposter said they were living in the apartment downstairs, and she was wrong. In the summer of 1947, John worked at Walgreens for a few weeks and then began work at the Dex Gold ice cream parlor. Now, that's important because it establishes where Pick was, what he was working at, and also Robert Oswald was there and so on. They were living at 1505 8th Avenue. On July 7th, 1947, Tarrant County Land Records show that Marguerite C. Ekdahl purchased a home at 101 San Sabat in Benbrook, a suburb of Fort Worth. She was then living at 1505 8th Avenue in Fort Worth. In the summer of 1947, Georgia Bell and her husband, Walter, were building their home directly across the street when a Mrs. Oswald and her young son moved into 101 San Saba. This is the first known sighting of the short, heavyset Marguerite Oswald imposter and the young Harvey Oswald. And it occurred at the same time Marguerite Clavery Ekdahl and her family were living with Edwin Ekdahl at 1505 8th Avenue in Fort Worth. Now, Marguerite Clavery Oswald purchased and owned this house in Benbrook, where the short, heavy Marguerite Oswald imposter and the young Russian-speaking Harvey were living. This was the beginning of merging the identities of two young boys, Lee Oswald and Harvey Oswald. Jack White and I visited Georgia Bell at her home in Benbrook on several occasions. Georgia, who lived at 100 San Saba more than 50 years, remembered buying groceries for the short, heavyset Mrs. Oswald, taking her to the store, and remembered that the young boy played with neighborhood children. Georgia said, quote, Mrs. Oswald often wore a white nurse's uniform. She did not have a car, and she was not very nice. Georgia remembered, quote, a neighbor, Lucille Hubbard, drove Mrs. Oswald to pick up some clothes from another house where she got a job when she got a job as a nurse. Mrs. Hubbard said Marguerite had furniture and lots of clothes stored at this house, which is located, quote, across from the Stripling School. We shall soon see this is almost certainly the same house in which 14-year-old Harvey and Marguerite were living in the fall of 1954, when Harvey was attending Stripling Junior High. This was also the house where the short, heavyset Marguerite Oswald imposter was living on November 22, 1963, when President Kennedy was assassinated. The address is 2220 Thomas Place in Fort Worth. I showed Georgia Bell, a photo of the Marguerite Oswald imposter standing next in front of a kitchen sink. Georgia said, quote, that's her, short and heavy, just like I remember her. I then showed Georgia a photo of the tall, nice-looking Marguerite Oswald standing next to Edwin Ekdahl on their wedding day in 1945, taken only 2 years before Georgia met Mrs. Oswald. And Georgia said, I don't know who that is. Neighbor Otis Carlton, a schoolteacher, said that young Oswald, Harvey, attended the first grade at Benbrook Common School, where Carlton's daughter taught fifth and sixth grade. While the Marguerite Oswald imposter and the young Russian-speaking Harvey Oswald were living in Benbrook, Lee Oswald was enrolled in the first grade at the Lily Clayton Elementary School in Fort Worth, spring 1947. In September, Lee Oswald entered the second grade at Lily Clayton Elementary in Fort Worth, while John and Robert returned to the Chamberlain Hunt Military Academy in Port Gibson, Mississippi. Georgia Bell said the Oswalds lived across the street during the summer and fall. They moved around Thanksgiving, 1947, and then a family named Charbonneau moved in. Otis Carlton said the Oswalds left Benbrook sometime in 1946 or 47. 6 months later, in March 1948, Marguerite Clavery Ekdahl separated from Mr. Ekdahl. Marguerite and Lee moved to 3300 Willing Street in Fort Worth next to the railroad tracks, as remembered by John Pick. On March 18, Lee Oswald transferred from Lily Clayton Elementary and began attending George Clark Elementary School. When John Pick and Robert returned from Chamberlain Hunt in 1948, his mother and Lee were living at 3300 Willing. Unfortunately, neither the FBI nor the Warren Commission interviewed the landlord of 3300 Willing to determine the exact dates of Oswald's residence. After Marguerite and Ekdahl's divorce was final on June 24, 1948, Pick said they moved into a little house in Benbrook and then moved in September to 7408 Ewing. Oswald's life at 7408 Ewing was the longest period of stability in Lee Oswald's young life. He completed grades 3 through 6, was given several IQ tests. Now, Lee Oswald's IQ, taken several times, averaged 102. He was described by his friends as a well-built, husky young boy and the tallest kid in the class. Now, this was personally told to me by former classmates of Oswald's, Philip Anderson, Frank Norwood, dentist Joe Skiles, Nancy Kuklis, and others. After the Marguerite Oswald imposter and young Harvey moved out of 101 San Saba, Marguerite C. Ekdahl rented out this property for the next 4.5 years. In June 1950, she wrote a letter to her son, John Picks, that she was renting the house. A week later, she listed the property for sale. At Christmas 1949, Lee Oswald's fourth grade teacher gave him a small puppy. The following year, a photograph, which appears in the Warren volumes, was taken of Lee Oswald and his dog at 101 San Saba. Georgia Bell said that a year later, 1951, Otis Carlton's home burned down. He then purchased 101 San Saba from Marguerite Oswald and moved in. Tarrant County land records show that the sale was completed on November 6, 1951. 9 days after selling San Saba, Marguerite Clavery Oswald purchased a small home at 4833 Birchman in Fort Worth. She rented this property for a year and a half and then sold it on April 27, 1953 while she was living in New York. The Warren Commission and the FBI supposedly researched all of the addresses where the Oswald family had lived, New Orleans, Dallas, Fort Worth, and all the properties owned by Mrs. Oswald. But for some unknown reason, they never reported, or they intentionally failed to report, that Mrs. Oswald owned 4833 Birchman. I mean, it's real simple to find out land records. You simply go to Tarrant County, Fort Worth, look at their records, you know, to grantor grantee indexes year by year, and it's right there. It's easy to find. The summer and fall of 1947 is the earliest known confirmation that two different Oswald families were living at two different locations at the same time. John Pick told the Warren Commission that in the summer of 1947, he was living with his mother at 1505 8th Avenue, working at the Tex Gold ice cream store. Robert Oswald discussed family matters in detail during his Warren Commission testimony. But when he was asked about the summer of 1947, Commission member Alan Dulles, former director of the CIA, asked for an adjournment. Dulles was likely concerned that Robert, like John Pick, would confirm that his family was living at 1505 8th Avenue during the summer of 1947, which would conflict with a second Oswald family living at 101 San Saba at the same time. Dulles' request for an adjournment strongly suggests that Dulles had intimate, detailed knowledge about the backgrounds of both Harvey and Lee. When Robert Oswald's testimony resumed, he was questioned about events that occurred beginning in the fall of 1948. No further questions about the summer of 1947. In July 1952, Robert Oswald joined the Marines. A month later, on August 20th, Marguerite sold her home in Fort Worth and drove her 1948 Dodge to New York City with Lee. Now, she and Lee moved in with John Pick and his wife in an apartment on 92nd Street in Manhattan that was rented by Marge's mother, Mrs. Mary Furman. Mrs. Furman was then living with her sister in Virginia. John Pick told the Warren Commission that his mother enrolled Lee in a school between 89th and 90th Street and between 2nd and 3rd Avenues, only a couple of blocks from the Pick's apartment. Pick said that his brother Lee did not like this school because Negroes were allowed to attend with white children, an understandable attitude for a Southern-born and Southern-raised Lee Oswald. The Warren Commission and the FBI knew about a school in Manhattan from the testimony of John Pick, but they never attempted to locate or secure any records from any school in Manhattan. Now, according to Robert Oswald, his brother Lee attended a second school in Manhattan. On page 63 of Lee, a book by Robert Oswald, Robert wrote, quote, Lee entered the eighth grade at public school 44 on Columbus Avenue at 76th Street. This school is the William J. O'Shea Junior High Public School, PS 44 in Manhattan. And that's 2.5 miles from the Pick's apartment. There are no Warren Commission or FBI records nor any information about Oswald's seventh or eighth grade attendance at any school in Manhattan at the National Archives. Now, it's interesting to remember that both John Pick and Robert Oswald said Lee attended junior high school in Manhattan. But the FBI gave the Warren Commission records for Oswald's attendance at PS 44 in the Bronx, 8 miles from the Pick's apartment. There's no doubt that Lee Oswald attended a school close to the Picks apartment and, according to Robert Oswald, attended a school in Manhattan on Columbus Avenue at 76th Street. But neither the FBI nor the Warren Commission produced any records from a school or schools in Manhattan. Those records disappeared long ago. It is worth remembering that Oswald's original school records were given to Judge Florence Kelly, who gave those records to the FBI. But weeks later, the FBI provided the Warren Commission with photographs, not original records, photographs of Oswald's attendance records. The only school records given to the Warren Commission were records from PS Public School, PS 117 and PS 44 in the Bronx. Not a single record from a school in Manhattan. It is also worth noting there are five PS 44 schools in New York City. PS, of course, means public school. PS 44 Manhattan, PS 44 Bronx, PS 44 Staten Island, PS 44 Brooklyn, PS 44 Queens. Multiple junior high schools identified as PS 44 in New York City. How convenient to place Lee Oswald at one PS 44 in Manhattan, while at the same time placing Harvey Oswald at a different PS 44 in the Bronx. And how utterly confusing for researchers and historians who might try to untangle and understand Oswald's attendance at, quote, PS 44 in New York City. The FBI and Warren Commission ignored the Warren Commission testimony of John Pick and Robert Oswald relating to Oswald's junior high school attendance in Manhattan. The FBI, after receiving school records from Judge Kelly, provided the Warren Commission only with photographs. And there were photographs from the Trinity Evangelical School in the Bronx, Public School 117 in the Bronx, and Public School 44 in the Bronx, 8 miles away from the Picks apartment. Now, Mrs. Dorrit Wolfe was an art teacher at PS 117 and remembered young Oswald as one of her seventh grade students. She described him as a very intelligent young boy who was small, introverted, slightly deaf, and who constantly truanted. This was Harvey Oswald, not the tall, husky, boisterous Lee Oswald, who was likely attending school close to the Picks apartment at the same time. Copies of school records for 117 show that Oswald attended only 15 days in school from 1952 through all March of 1953. Mrs. Wolfe remembered writing reams of letters to school counselors requesting help for young Oswald. Harvey Oswald lived with his caretaker, mother, at 825 East 179 from the autumn 1952 until the summer 1953, only 3 blocks from the Bronx Zoo. Harvey Oswald constantly truanted or attended various schools briefly, while Lee Oswald's attendance records at schools was very good. I personally think that his truancy might have had something to do with his lack of expertise in the English language, but that's just my thinking. Harvey was remembered as a loner by a fellow student, Lana Greenberg, his 12-year-old neighbor. Their small apartment was only a few blocks from the Bronx Zoo, where Robert Oswald took a photo of the small, slender Harvey in 1953. Now, Robert Oswald most certainly knew the small, quiet, introverted boy was not his brother. When this photograph was shown to John Pick, he told the Warren Commission, quote, "Sir, from that photo, I could not recognize that is Lee Harvey Oswald." John Pick refused to identify Harvey Oswald as his brother. The Warren Commission also asked John Pick to identify a photograph of Oswald handing out Fair Play for Cuba Committee literature in New Orleans in 1963. Pick said, quote, "No, sir, I would be unable to recognize him." John Pick told the Warren Commission that he did not recognize the man handing out leaflets, Harvey Oswald, the man accused of killing President Kennedy. He did not recognize this man as his half-brother. Harvey Oswald's continual truancy at Public School 117 came to the attention of the Bureau of Attendance. He was adjudged a school truant, ordered to appear in court, and they remanded him to youth house in Manhattan. Psychologist Irving Sokolow described Oswald as a slender youngster, gave him an IQ test. Harvey achieved an IQ test of 118, considerably higher than the IQ score of 102 that Lee Oswald received in Fort Worth and later in New Orleans. Probation Officer John Caro described young Oswald Harvey as a small boy, a bright boy, a likable boy, and remembered that he was extremely guarded when discussing certain areas of his life. Caro took Oswald to the office of Dr. Milton Kurian. Kurian was surprised to learn that Oswald was 13 years old. Dr. Kurian said, quote, he appeared quite small for his age and stood no more than 4'6" or 4'8". He was very quiet and introverted. Oswald told Dr. Kurian that he never went to school, but on occasion, now this is important, Oswald told Dr. Kurian that his brother would substitute for him and take his place in school. On May 1st, Utah psychologist Renatus Hartogs examined Oswald. In his book, The Two Assassins, Hartogs described Oswald as a slender, dark-haired boy with a pale, haunted face. I remember thinking how slack he seemed for his 13 years. He had an underfed look, reminiscent of the starved children I had seen in concentration camps. While Harvey was in youth house, John Caro interviewed the short, heavyset Marguerite Oswald imposter. This imposter told Caro that Oswald's father died at age 45, when in fact he died at age 42. She said she and her husband were married for the first time on July 19, 1929. When in fact, Marguerite Claverly and Robert E. Lee Oswald were married July 15, 1933, and it was the second marriage for both. The Marguerite Oswald imposter told Caro that their family owned a home in Corning, Texas, but there was never a city in Texas with the name Corning. She gave the incorrect date for Oswald's birthday and then mistakenly identified her sister as Lillian Segore, when in fact her sister's name was Lillian Moret. This imposter told Caro that her son was baptized at the Trinity Lutheran Church, but Lee Oswald was baptized at Redeemer Lutheran Church in New Orleans. These are just a few of the errors made by the Marguerite Oswald imposter during her interview with John Caro, but she made many, many more errors, as we shall see. The FBI and Warren Commission reported that young Oswald attended only 15 days of school at PS 117 and was then remanded to the youth house. But neither the FBI or Warren Commission explained why this habitual truant was promoted to the eighth grade. The reason, of course, is that Harvey never attended PS 44 and was never promoted. It was Lee Oswald, with a good attendance record, who was promoted to the eighth grade at PS 44. After the assassination, Special Agent John Malone, the agent in charge of the New York office, inspected Oswald's original court file in the presence of Judge Florence Kelly. Malone took notes and sent a report to FBI Director Hoover the following day. Malone wrote, quote, Oswald's attendance were in PS 44 from March 23, 1953 to January 12, 1954 was 171 and 11 half days present and 18 and 11 half days absent. If Lee Oswald's 182 days of attendance and 18 absences are plotted on a 1954 and 1955 calendar, it is easy to see that Lee Oswald attended Public School 44 full time during the entire 1953 school year. Lee Oswald attended Public School 44 regularly, was not truant from January through March, did not attend court, and was not placed in the youth house from April 16th through May 1953. There's no time. Lee Oswald's attendance at Public School 44 in Manhattan was at the same time Harvey was chronically absent and truant from Public School 117 in October, November, and December, and January, February, and March of 1953. We had two records, two school records, from two different Public School 44s that were combined to show that there was one Lee Oswald. It was Harvey Oswald who was placed in youth house from April 16th through May 7th. It was the small, thin, 4'8", malnourished Harvey who appeared with Marguerite Oswald imposter on court at numerous occasions. Now, further confirmation that Lee Oswald attended Public School 44 in 1953 can be found simply by looking at Oswald's health card, dated May 1953. This health card shows Lee Oswald's height at 5'4" and his weight at 114 pounds. Clearly, not the 4'6" or 4'8" Harvey Oswald, who was interviewed by Dr. Kieran at Youth House the previous month, or the malnourished young boy remembered by Dr. Hartogs at Youth House, or the small boy remembered by probation officer John Carl. The boy who attended Public School 144 was the tall, well-built, husky Lee Oswald from Fort Worth, the tallest kid in his sixth grade class who always attended school regularly. 3 months later, in September, Lee Oswald's height was listed on his eighth grade health card as 5'4". The 1952-53 junior high school records from New York are very important smoking guns because they show school records of Harvey and Lee were merged together by the FBI, photographed, the original records destroyed, and photographs were then given to the Warren Commission in an attempt to show there was only one Lee Harvey Oswald. Lee Oswald attended Public School 44 in the Bronx, January through December 1953, without incident. But where was Harvey? And what was he doing in the summer and fall of 1953? Louise Robertson was a housekeeper employed by Margaret Oswald Imposter for 6 weeks in the summer of 1953 to clean her apartment 2 or 3 days a week. Mrs. Oswald, the imposter, told Louise that she brought her son to New York so he could have mental tests performed at the Jacoby Hospital. Could young Harvey Oswald, instead of truanting, have been spending some of his days at the Jacoby Hospital? Mrs. Robinson remembered that while she was working at her apartment shortly before Mrs. Oswald left New York City in the summer of 1953, but she did not know where they had gone. In the summer of 1953, 12-year-old William Henry Timmer was living with his grandmother in the small community of Stanley, North Dakota. Timmer and his friends were riding bicycles when they noticed an older boy riding nearby. The boy introduced himself as Harv, or Harvey, said he came from New York City, and soon began talking about communism. He took a pamphlet about communism from his pocket and showed it to the boys. Following the assassination, Timmer's mother wrote a letter to President Johnson and advised that young Oswald had lived briefly in Stanley, North Dakota, and knew her son. This is the first time the small, slender, introverted Oswald referred to himself as Harvey. In the fall of 1953, Lee Oswald was attending the eighth grade in Public School 44 in the Bronx in New York, while Harvey Oswald and his caretaker mother were living at 126 Exchange Place in New Orleans. Harvey was enrolled in the eighth grade at Beauregard Junior High, and because he attended school part-time, he was not assigned a homeroom. On page 817 of Warren Volume 22, there's a copy of Oswald's school records at Beauregard. Look at them. The fall semester of 1953, while Lee was in New York, shows that Oswald attended a general science class, a physical education class, and attended 89 days of school with one absence. The second row is for the last half of the eighth grade, the spring semester. The third row shows the final grades and tardies for the entire 53-54 school year. Now, school records clearly show that Harvey Oswald attended Beauregard in New Orleans in the fall of 1953, while at the same time, the New York City school records show that Lee Oswald was attending Public School 44 in New York City. Harvey was in New Orleans, Lee was in New York from September through December 1953. At the beginning of the second semester, eighth grade, in January 1954, Harvey walked into Myra DeRusse's eighth grade homeroom in the basement cafeteria. The 53-54 school year was the only year during which Myra had a homeroom, and she remembered the day she met young Oswald. I knew Myra. I knew her quite well. In fact, she invited me one year to stay at her home with her husband, LaRue, during Mardi Gras, and she took me to Mardi Gras. Well, here's what, and there's a long interview that Robert Croden and I did with Myra on YouTube, if anyone's interested to look at it. Myra said, well, the first day he came into my homeroom, he handed me his file. When I read that his name was Lee Harvey Oswald, I said to him, quote, how do you want to be called? And he told me to call him Harvey. So I always called him Harvey. I knew him only as Harvey. This was the second time that the thin, slender young man called himself Harvey. In 1954, young Oswald wanted to be called Harvey. So after talking with Bill Timmer and Myra DeRusse, I began referring to the smaller, thinner, quiet young boy as Harvey. Meyer described Harvey as a, quote, a little fellow, scrawny, skinny, and quiet. He came about the middle of my chest, about 4'6" tall. When Lee Oswald began attending Beauregard in January 1954, he filled out a personal history sheet where he listed his height at 5'5" and weighed 135 pounds. Now, Lee Oswald was much heavier and slightly taller than Myra, whereas Harvey was very thin and quite a bit shorter than Myra. Myra saw Harvey every day before school, sitting on the front steps, waiting for school to open, and she thought he was lonely. She saw him in her homeroom, in class, after school, riding bicycles on the grounds with Ed Vogel. On one occasion, after school, Vogel ran up to Myra and shouted, quote, Mr. Roos, come quick, a piano fell on Harvey. So Myra and fellow teacher Dorothy Dubik followed Vogel into the basement cafeteria and found Harvey on the floor with a small upright piano laying across his legs. The two women lifted the piano off of Harvey, and then, with the principal's permission, Myra drove Harvey to the Monta Lepre Clinic on Canal Street. After examination by a physician, Myra drove Harvey to his home on Exchange Alley and asked where his mother was. Harvey replied, quote, she's working in a bar. While Harvey and his caretaker mother were living in a small apartment on Exchange Alley, Lee Oswald and his tall, nice-looking mother were living 3.5 miles away in an apartment at 1454 St. Mary's. The apartment building was owned and operated by Julian and Myrtle Evans, who had known the tall, nice-looking Margaret Oswald for over 20 years. Remember, it was Julian Evans who told the Warren Commission that Marguerite was, quote, a beautiful woman with black hair, a real fashion plate who dressed beautifully. In the spring of 1954, while Harvey was in Myra DeRusse's eighth grade homeroom class in the basement cafeteria, school records published in the Warren Commission volume show that Lee Oswald was also in Beauregard, and he was in homeroom 303 on the third floor. On each and every one of Lee Oswald's eighth grade report cards is the notation 303, and a student progress report that read, quote, Lee Oswald, grade 8, homeroom 303. These records show that tall, husky Lee Oswald was in homeroom 303 in the eighth grade at Beauregard in the spring semester of 1954, while at the same time, the short, thin, quiet Harvey Oswald was in Myra DeRusse's homeroom class in the basement cafeteria. When I told Myra that Oswald's school report cards listed his homeroom as 303, she said, that's impossible. He was in my homeroom in the basement cafeteria. I then showed Myra the photograph of Harvey Oswald taken at the Bronx Zoo in 1953 in New York. She said, that's him, just like I remember him. And then I showed Myra the classroom photo of tall, husky Lee Oswald taken in October 1954 at Beauregard that appeared in Life magazine. Myra looked at that photo a long time, and she said, quote, that's not Harvey. That's not the boy from my homeroom. Look at this boy. He looks like a football player. And Harvey was skinny. And it appears that Harvey has a broken tooth. I'm sorry, Lee has a broken tooth, sitting in the classroom chair. Myra saw Harvey Oswald every day during the spring semester of 1954 at Beauregard, before school, in her homeroom, in the school library, and after school. Ed Vogel and Harvey were good friends, and they were always riding their bicycles together after school. Vogel was with Harvey when the piano fell on his legs. But after school ended, in June 1954, neither Myra nor Ed Vogel ever saw Harvey Oswald again. In October 1954, a few months later, Ed Vogel saw a young boy in a fight with Johnny and Mike Neumeyer. After the fight ended, Vogel helped clean up the young man. He thought the boy lost a tooth during the fight, and he soon became friends with a tall, husky Lee Oswald. I spoke with Johnny Neumeyer for hours. And he did not know if Oswald got, you know, lost a tooth, but he clearly remembered the fight with he and his brother and Lee Oswald. A few days later, Vogel was with Oswald on the steps of Beauregard when a young man named Robin Riley punched Lee Oswald in the mouth, cutting his lip badly. Once again, Vogel helped clean up Oswald, and their friendship began to develop. Soon after the fight, Vogel took a photo of Lee Oswald sitting at a desk in Helen DeFer's English class at Beauregard, which he later sold to Life magazine for $75. 7 months later, Vogel attended a pre-high school conference with Oswald at Warren Easton High School. A month later, in June 1955, Vogel and Lee Oswald began attending Civil Air Patrol meetings. Following the assassination of JFK, Ed Vogel saw Margaret Oswald's imposter's photo on television and in the newspapers. And he told the Warren Commission, quote, "I had a picture in my mind which was very different from when I saw her in the paper after all this happened. I didn't recognize her." Vogel was a young man who befriended the short, skinny Harvey Oswald in the eighth grade and tall, husky Lee Oswald in the ninth grade. He met Lee Oswald's mother, the tall, nice-looking Margaret Oswald, but did not recognize the heavy-set Margaret Oswald imposter after the assassination. Vogel's friendship with the small, quiet Harvey Oswald in the eighth grade and later the taller, husky Lee Oswald in the ninth grade was nothing more than a coincidence, but it was likely he died. The reason he died at age 32. Following the assassination of President Kennedy, anyone who came in contact with both Harvey and Lee Oswald posed a serious threat to the CIA. People like Guy Bannister, David Ferry, Edward Vogel. Knowledge of two Lee Harvey Oswalds could uncover and expose the CIA's Oswald project and establish a direct link with the CIA to the assassination of President Kennedy. If Ed Vogel were to realize that the accused assassin of President Kennedy was Harvey Oswald, who he knew in the eighth grade, and not Lee Oswald, who he knew in the ninth grade at Beauregard and the Civil Air Patrol, then Vogel's coincidental friendship with Harvey and Lee had the potential to expose the Oswald Project. What did Vogel know? From Ira DeRusse, we know that Vogel and Harvey were good friends in the winter spring of 1954. An FBI document refers to an interview of Vogel where he states that he visited Oswald's apartment, the Senator Hotel. But there's no documents to show the FBI Warren Commission or anyone asked or questioned Vogel about his friendship with Harvey Oswald during the spring semester of 1954. We know that Vogel met Lee Oswald for the first time in October 54 when he got into a fight with Johnny Neumeier. Vogel frequently visited Lee Oswald and his mother at Exchange Place after his weekly music lesson. Their friendship continued through the early summer of 1955 when both attended meetings of the Civil Air Patrol at Moisant Airport. There's a photo of Lee Oswald wearing a CAP uniform, the uniform that was purchased by Robert Oswald. But of course, this uniform, the cap, the tie, and attached CAP logos belonged to Lee Oswald, and they were not found among Harvey Oswald's possessions after the assassination. Ed Vogel's knowledge of Harvey and Lee may have been the reason he died at the young age of 32, only one day after being admitted to the Ochsner Clinic in New Orleans. I spoke of Vogel's sister on several occasions in New Orleans. She had no idea why her brother died. But one day, he called home, said he was not feeling well, he was going to stay in the hospital. The next day, he was dead. His father said that his son died under mysterious circumstances. He told the House Select Committee that he thought his son's death had something to do with Oswald and the JFK assassination, but he had no proof. After graduating from the eighth grade in June 1954, Harvey Oswald and his caretaker mother relocated to Fort Worth, Texas, and lived in the small duplex apartment at 2220 Thomas Place. In September, Harvey entered the ninth grade at Stripling Junior High in Fort Worth, while at the same time, Lee Oswald was in the ninth grade in Beauregard in New Orleans getting in fights with Johnny Neumeier. That same year, an eighth grade student at Stripling, Francetta Schubert, ate her lunch on the school grounds every day and watched Harvey as he walked across the street to his house at 2220 Thomas Place for lunch. He described Oswald as a skinny, quiet boy who wore a brown leather jacket and jeans. Fran used to see Oswald's mother and remembered that she was short, heavy set, and always wore a white nurse's uniform. 2220 Thomas Place is probably the same house where the Margaret Oswald imposter stored clothes and furniture when she lived across the street from Georgia Bell in 1947. In the fall of 1954, Margaret and Harvey lived in a small apartment at the rear of this white, one-story wood frame building. 9 years later, on November 22nd, 1963. After moving many times, living in many different cities, the Marguerite Oswald imposter was once again living at 2220 Thomas Place and wearing a white nurse's uniform the day President Kennedy was killed. Fellow classmate Doug Gann remembered that Oswald played basketball, shot baskets after school, and lived in a white house across the street. Bobby Pitson's brother used to play touch football in front of Oswald's house and remembered that Oswald often stood on the front porch and watched. Gym teacher Mark Summers, who began teaching at Stripling in 1950, remembered that Oswald was in his gym class. Early Saturday morning, the day after the assassination, Mr. Wiley, principal of Stripling Junior High, called the assistant principal, Frank Cudlady, at his home. Mr. Wiley told Cudley to immediately go to Stripling and meet two FBI agents who would arrive shortly and to give them Oswald's school records. In 1963, school records from prior years were kept at each school. Frank told me, I lived close to the school at that time and arrived at the school before they got there. I went into the school, located Oswald's records. In fact, I found Lee and Robert Oswald's records for Stripling. I opened Lee Harvey Oswald's folder, briefly looked over his records, and noted that he attended less than a full semester at Stripling. He'd been there long enough to receive grades for a six-week period, but not long enough to receive semester grades. I think he was in the ninth grade. I put the records back in the folder and waited for the agents. When they arrived, they showed me their badges for identification and asked for the records. I told them I located both Lee and Robert's records and asked if they wanted both. They told me they only wanted Lee Harvey Oswald's records. After I handed the records to them, they thanked me and left. I locked up the school and went home. Harvey Oswald's junior high school records from Stripling, confiscated within 20 hours of the assassination, clearly show that FBI Director Hoover knew those Stripling records could expose the two Oswalds. The confiscation and disappearance of the Stripling records is another smoking gun that shows Hoover probably had prior knowledge of Harvey and Lee. In early 1955, Harvey Oswald and his caretaker mother left Fort Worth and returned to New Orleans. The Marguerite Oswald imposter found work at the Dolly Shoe Company while Harvey applied for a work permit. Harvey soon began work at Dolly Shoe along with his caretaker mother. A copy of his work permit was sent to Mary Miller, a social worker at Beauregard. Mary recalled handling a case that involved a student who lived on Exchange Alley and remembered there was an attendance problem. Harvey had the attendance problem because he was working full-time at Dolly Shoe in the spring of 1955 when he should have been attending junior high. While Harvey was working at Dolly Shoe, Lee Oswald was attending Beauregard with a near-perfect attendance record. Store manager Mari Goodman and co-worker Rita Pavier remembered that the short, heavy-set Marguerite Oswald worked as a barmaid at local bars before and after she worked at Dolly Shoe. A year earlier, in the spring of 1954, Harvey Oswald told his homeroom teacher, Myra DeRoos, that his mother worked at a bar. I sent Mr. Goodman and Rita photographs of the heavyset Marguerite Oswald imposter in 1954 and photographs of Harvey Oswald from the Arlington Heights school yearbook. They immediately recognized Harvey and the Marguerite Oswald imposter as their former co-workers. They remembered Oswald as a skinny boy, 4'8", 4'10" tall, and Marguerite as short and heavy set. I also sent them a photo of the nice-looking Marguerite Oswald taken at Christmas time, 1957, Paul's Shoe Store, and the classroom photograph of Lee Oswald taken at Beauregard in 1954. Neither Mr. Goodman nor Rita recognized these people. In April 1955, Mr. Goodman hired Louis Marzali as store manager, and his first day of work was Tuesday, April 12th, the day his first son was born. Lewis arrived at 10 a.m. and began observing Harvey Oswald and other store employees. While having lunch with Mr. Goodman, Lewis recommended they fire young Oswald, which they did. Marguerite was also fired because she refused repeatedly to fill out insurance company bonding forms, which, if completed, may have raised unanswerable questions relating to two different women using the name Marguerite Oswald. After Marguerite was fired, Lewis recalled that she went to work at the Tradewinds Bar on Decatur Street. After Lee completed the ninth grade in May 1955, he began working at the Jared F. Tujak under the direction of Frank DiBenedetto. Robert Oswald, who stayed with Lee and his mother for 1 week in July 55, remembered that his brother was then working for an import-export company. Now, this is so important. Frank told the House Select Committee that Oswald worked at Two Jacks, quote, a year to a year and a half. This was extremely important because the Warren Commission reported that Oswald worked at Two Jacks only 3 months. I quickly realized I needed to meet and talk with Frank. In 1995, I traveled to New Orleans and met Frank at Two Jacks' office in the Sandlin Building, the same building and the same office where Lee Oswald worked 40 years earlier. Frank described Oswald, then 16 years old, as well-built, 5'10" tall, very different from the 4'10" Harvey who worked for Dolly Shoe just a few months earlier. Frank told me, like he told the House Select Committee, that Lee worked for him a year, maybe longer. I knew that Oswald began working at Two Jacks in early summer 1955. And I asked Frank if he remembered when Oswald quit working. Frank said, yes. He quit, it was hot, and he quit to join the Marines. Now, working at Two Jacks from June 55 through the end of summer 56 was 1 year and 3 months. Frank DiBenedetto's statement to the House Select Committee was correct. Oswald worked at Two Jacks for a year to a year and a half. In 1995, Two Jacks Secretary Gloria Callahan was still working for the company, and she remembered that Oswald was working for Two Jacks when she went on maternity leave in March. Now, this is extremely important. Lee Oswald working at Two Jacks from June 1955 through August 1956 was a serious problem because in September and October 1955, Oswald was attending Warren Easton High School. In Oswald's school file at Warren Easton, there's a note dated October 8th, says, we're moving to San Diego. This is the first indication that Harvey Oswald and his caretaker mother may have moved to San Diego, California in late 1955. The second indication they briefly lived in California comes from Laurel Kittrell, who interviewed Harvey Oswald in early October 1963 at the Texas Employment Commission. Harvey told Ms. Kittrell he lived in California. He said, quote, it was before I went into the Marines. It was just when I was 16. I had this messenger job, boy job in California. It was a motor scooter messenger boy job, but I worked in the office too, filing and taking care of mail. It was for an investment company. I worked there 6 months. The name of it was the ETI Realty Company. And Laura remembered the name of the city as Encino, California. When Oswald mentioned the name Murray Chotiner, who was a close friend of Richard Nixon, Laura asked Oswald how he knew the name Murray Chotiner. She said, did you work for Murray Chotiner in California? The young man replied, he's a crook. And Laura wondered how the young man could have known the name of a little known political figure in another state. In January 1956, Oswald and his caretaker mother returned to New Orleans. Now, the Warren Commission reported that after Oswald's employment at Two Jack ended, he began working for the J.R. Michaels Company in January. The Warren Commission then reported that Oswald began working for Pfister Dental Laboratory for several months in 1956 without a single piece of documentation. It is now very clear that while Lee Oswald was working at Two Jacks from June 1955 through August 1956, Harvey Oswald was attending Warren Easton High School. Then he briefly lived and worked in California and then returned to New Orleans and worked for the J.R. Michaels Company. The Warren Commission shortened the Two Jacks employment from a year and a half down to 3 months, November, December, and January 1955. While in New Orleans, I met with Jimmy Hutton, a former employee who worked for Two Jacks. Jimmy told me that on the day of the assassination, while employees were having lunch, Mr. Two Jack told everyone, quote, the FBI will be here soon, so you can all take the rest of the day off. That afternoon, the FBI did arrive, and they confiscated all of Lee Oswald's original payroll records and checks. Now, Warren Easton High School records show that Oswald's attendance ended on October 10th. The FBI then carefully selected and photographed Lee Oswald's time cards at Two Jacks for October, November, and December, which was after Oswald dropped out of school on October 10th, but before Oswald began working at J.R. Michaels in January 1956. The Warren Commission pieced together these two young boys' histories and employment, and gave photographs of their results to the Warren Commission. Photographs of Oswald's time cards for November, December, January. And one document from Oswald's employment with J.R. Michaels in January 1956, but not a single verifiable document for Oswald's alleged employment at the Pfister Dental Laboratory in the spring of 1956. The Warren Commission accepted the FBI's photographs and was then able to report that one person, Lee Harvey Oswald, attended Warren Easton High School, worked 3 months at Two Jacks, worked 2 weeks at J.R. Michaels, and then a few months at the Pfister Dental Laboratory.
John, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Is that the? Are you done? That's fantastic.
No. I've got about five more minutes, but the time is up. So I don't
got you. No. If you want, we can go over if you want to. If you want to wrap it up, that's fine.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Okay. The FBI gave the Warren Commission photographs of Oswald's Warren Easton High School records, photographs of Oswald's time cards and his employment, photographs of his one document of his employment at J.R. Michaels in January. The Warren Commission accepted the FBI's photographs and was then able to report that one person, attended Warren Easton High School, worked at Two Jacks, worked at J.R. Michaels, and then the Pfister Dental Laboratory. Now, in reality, when Lee Oswald was in the Marines in Japan in 1957 and 1958, it was then that Harvey Oswald was working in New Orleans at the Pfister Dental Laboratory. But once again, the FBI went to the dental lab, confiscated all the records, and warned all of the employees not to talk to anybody. Now, if either the FBI, the Warren Commission, the House Select Committee, or the ARRB wanted to verify Oswald's employment for Dolly Shoe, for Two Jacks, for J.R. Michaels, or for the Pfister Dental Laboratory, all they had to do was obtain payroll records from the Louisiana Department of Revenue, tax information from the IRS, or records from Social Security. However, if any of these government agencies released these records, then the existence of Harvey Oswald and Lee Oswald would have been exposed. I now understood the work and school history for Harvey and Lee in 1955 and 56, but I also want to know where they were living at this time. I knew that while Lee Oswald was working for Two Jacks, he was living at 126 Exchange, but where were Harvey and the Margaret Oswald imposter living? Where were they living in 1955 when Harvey attended Warren Easton, and in early 1956 while he worked for J.R. Michaels? The New Orleans City Directory for 1956 lists two Marguerite Oswalds living at two different addresses. One listing is for the real Marguerite Oswald, who was then working at Krieger's department store and living at 126 Exchange. A second listing shows a Margaret Oswald at 120 North Telemachus Street with no employment information. 120 North Telemachus is just off Canal Street and is the district for Warren Easton High School. I was curious to find two Margaret Oswalds listed in the 1956 New Orleans City Directory and wanted to know more about 120 North Telemachus. I visited the Land Records Division of Orleans Parish in New Orleans and located land ownership records for 120 North Telemachus. What I found, to my amazement, was completely unexpected. This property, since the 1930s, was owned by Margaret Emma Keating, the first wife of Robert Lee Oswald, the father of Lee Oswald. From 1933 to 1966, the title to Telemachus was in the name of Margaret Keating. Her name appears in the city directories, in the censuses, as Margaret Keating, never Margaret Oswald. But the 1956 city directory shows a Margaret Keating and a Margaret Oswald living at 120 North Telemachus Street. Why, in 1956, does the New Orleans City Directory show Margaret Oswald and Margaret Keating both former wives of Robert Oswald, living 120 North Telemachus. Why? Following the assassination of JFK, I found it interesting that Margaret Keating left her home on Telemachus Street and moved into apartment number 708 at 1205 St. Charles Street. 2 years later, she returned to her home on Telemachus. Now, I don't know if Margaret Keating had anything to do with Harvey and Lee, but further research is needed. In June 1956, Harvey and the Margaret Oswald imposter relocated once again to Fort Worth and moved into an apartment in a two-story brick building at 4936 Collinwood. Robert Oswald moved in with them, with the Margaret Oswald imposter, and with Harvey Oswald, and he opened a savings account at the Westside State Bank. He listed his address as 4936 Collinwood. Robert and his future wife, Veda, became engaged while he was living in this apartment. According to Mrs. Taylor, the landlord, Oswald lived in the apartment until he joined the Marines in October. And Robert stayed in the apartment until he and Veda were married on November 20th. Now, Robert never introduced his future wife to Harvey or to the Margaret Oswald imposter, even though he was living with both of them, most likely because he was not related to them. It should also be noted that John Pick told the FBI that in his estimation, Robert Oswald knows considerably more about Lee Harvey Oswald than he does. These are some of the reasons that Robert Oswald and his knowledge of both Harvey and Lee is one of the few living smoking guns. He was living when I wrote this. While Harvey and the Margaret Oswald imposter and Robert were living at 4936 Collinwood, the tall, nice-looking Margaret Oswald and Lee were still living in New Orleans. On July 31st, Margaret Oswald terminated her employment at Gold Rings department store. Lee ended his year-long employment at Two Jacks around the same time, and mother and son moved to Fort Worth. Lee and his tall, nice-looking mother moved into an apartment in a small four-unit building at 3830 West 6th in Fort Worth, next door to fellow tenant Lee McCracken. Additional records, statements from Lee McCracken, and the Fort Worth City Directory show the tall, nice-looking Margaret Oswald lived at this address from August 1956 through early 1958, while at the same time, the short, heavy-set Margaret Oswald imposter lived at 4936 Collinwood. Harvey enrolled at Arlington Heights High School on September 6, 1956, but the short, thin Harvey was not recognized by classmates who knew the much taller, husky Lee Oswald only 3 years earlier in grammar school. Richard Garrett knew Lee Oswald quite well in grade school and watched as Harvey walked up to him in the hall at Arlington Heights. Garrett told Life magazine, quote, "I remember I had to look down on him, and it seemed strange because he had been the tallest, the most dominant member of our group in grammar school. He looked like he was just lost. He was very different from the way I remember him, and he tried to sell me on communism." Philip Anderson, who I knew very well, knew Oswald in grade school, spent the night at his house on several occasions, said the Oswald he met in Arlington Heights High School was, quote, "not the same person that he knew in grade school." 3 weeks after enrolling in Arlington Heights High School, Harvey Oswald withdrew from school and joined the Marines. That's the end.
Well, wonderful, John. And then, you know, I feel like if I was in the audience, I would be standing up and applauding. But that's just fascinating stuff. And that's, I'm sure most of the audience realize that's just really a very small snippet of what you can find in John Armstrong's research in the book Harvey and Lee, harveyandlee.net, his records that are at Baylor University. They're all accessible online. So just, you know, thanks so much for sharing it with us, John. And any closing thoughts?
Do you have any questions?
Well, I think that you covered everything. Let me see here. There's something, just a couple. The people had lots of questions in the chat room, but but most of them, you know, applied to what you said. Where's the one? One person said, "Do you have an older picture of John Pick?"
The latest picture we have of John Pick would have been in the short movie clip when they had Thanksgiving in 1962 together at Robert Oswald's house.
Okay, and I think, let's see. I think that was the only one that really pertained to, do you know what the,
You're saying a picture of John Pick?
Yes, yes. They want to know if you have an older one, I guess. That's the way they phrased it, I guess, maybe when he was younger or something. I don't know.
Oh, God. No. Childhood pictures, maybe 4 or 5 years old, 6 years old, something like that. And the next one, I believe, is that I know about would be Thanksgiving when he was sitting on a couch with his wife at Thanksgiving time, 1962.
Cool. And just one more question. If you don't, feel free. I know this is a little off, but somebody asked early on if you know anything about Thomas Arthur Valley, the guy that, you know, that was in the aborted Chicago possible assassination attempt. Do you know if there are any connections with Oswald or Ruby there? Or was that even part of your research?
That is a question that is open in my mind. And whoever asked that question, whoever's listening, I would encourage them, please, read what I wrote about the Wes Wise allegation on the HarveyandLee.net website. There's no question that it was Wes Wise, the future mayor of Dallas, who was the reason all of this stuff was so confusing. You have to read it in detail, but Wes Wise was 100% the cause of all the confusion. The FBI agent Charles Brown interviewed Mr. White, who worked for Mac Pate's garage, a month after the assassination, and he got the direct answer, direct information right from Mr. White. Mr. White told him, I saw Lee Oswald sitting at 2 o'clock in the afternoon in a red 1961 Ford Falcon.
Right.
And the license plate number were PP4537. Now, those license plate numbers belong to Carl Mathers, 1957 Plymouth, Blue Plymouth. But Lee Oswald, supposedly in Arthur Valley, was driving a car. Now, look, this is not my research. This is me hearing about other people's research. So don't take it as gospel. But
right.
I remember reading, hearing that Valley was arrested in a Ford car, Ford Falcon car. It may have been
yes.
a Ford Falcon car that was registered to Lee Oswald.
Yes.
I think in New York.
Yeah, that was the arrest. Supposedly that was why there was so much of a cover up there, because there was some kind of a connection to Oswald, supposedly.
Well, if that was true, if Lee Oswald did register a red Ford Falcon in New York, and if it was the same time, I mean, my God, he couldn't have his own license plates on his own car after Harvey sitting in jail. And you've got Carl Mathers' license plate appearing on, and of course, Texas has license plates front and back, so they easily could have pulled a plate. Someone could have pulled a plate off the front of Mathers' car and put it on the rear of the Ford Falcon.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but they did have those questions for you there, and there are more. But I'm not gonna. We could be here for another hour if we did that. But I hope maybe because this is – there's so much material here to cover. And, again, we just covered one small aspect, 10-year period. But maybe we can do another show where we do another time period and cover another part of RV and Lee if you're willing to.
Well, it gets – as you go on, the records of Oswald in Japan and the Marines. I mean, I've talked to several people who knew Oswald in Japan, who, you know, just they were with him every single day, and the discrepancies of where he was and what was going on, the Pfister Dental Laboratory, all that stuff. There's records of Oswald in Santa Ana, California, in October, when Lee is still waiting for the boat, November 3rd, to go back to the United States. I mean.
Right.
Yeah, all these little details, all these little things clearly show something was going on. When Oswald's in Russia, you've got all these sightings of Oswald in the United States, you know, refueling his boat in Florida, trying to buy Jeeps to send to Cuba, the Dallas Garland Airport, trying to find pilots to do flights over Cuba. It goes on and on and on. And then the thing that really opened my eyes one day was reviewing all the documents I had on Jack Ruby. And what I found, I file all my records by date. And when I started reading 1962, 63, I had to break 63 down by the month because there were so many sightings of Oswald and Ruby together. And it suddenly occurred to me, Jack Ruby and Oswald at the Carousel Club, Jack Ruby and Oswald at the electronics place, and so on and so on. And it suddenly dawned on me, now wait a minute, this is the summer of 1963. Oswald and Marina are in New Orleans. And that's what caused me to come to the conclusion, maybe it was Ruby and Lee Oswald that had the close connection, and maybe it was Ruby who was giving Oswald instructions as to how to set up Harvey to take the fall as the patsy for killing President Kennedy.
Yeah, that certainly sounds reasonable. Well, I just one more question, because two different people asked this. What about Jim Norton, the guy Mabe Russell and Penn Jones met?
That's Donald Norton.
Oh, okay, Donald Norton. Okay, they both said okay.
I spent a lot of time researching Donald Norton. After John Judge told me the Donald Norton story, I contacted the title company in Ohio, and I was able to secure the deed where they signed off the property and sold the property, 1990-something, whatever it was. And what I was interested in was not their signatures. I was interested in the notary stamp. I wanted to see where they were when they signed the title to the deed. They were in Florida. So I took a plane, went down to Florida. And at that time, you could go in and give them a name, and you know, they would give you driver's license information. And I found Donald Norton living within a quarter mile of Burt Reynolds Ranch in Jupiter, Florida. I only mention that because it had a sign on it for sale. The property was for sale, and Burt Reynolds Ranch had a payphone. So I called the realtor and told him I was interested in buying the house. I wanted to go in the house and see if I could see photographs of Donald Norton and his wife. And there was absolutely, it's like going into a hotel room. There was a bed, there was a dresser, but there was nothing personal. I mean, nothing personal.
Wow.
And I talked to a few of the neighbors who said that he only came home once or twice a year, would sit out with a fishing pole by his little pond, and he'd sit there for hours and talk to another fellow who worked for him in Florida, who said that he never stayed home. He always would stay in a motel and move from motel to motel to motel to motel, trying to run his advertising business. A very strange fellow. And when I tried to find, he was working then for a retirement home, a nationwide retirement home. And I called up and I said, is Don there? Well, he's busy right now. So I drove over to the place and someone told me, no, he's in the one in Jacksonville. Okay, fine. So I drove 100 miles to Jacksonville. No, he's over in Nashville, Tennessee. So no matter what I tried to do, I couldn't come face to face with him. And one of my friends, Art Swanson, was able to get a hold of him selling fishing tackle in Florida. And Art Swanson just asked him directly, you know, are you Lee Harvey Oswald? And Norton kind of got panicky and said, no. And he said, can you smile? Can I see your teeth? He said, all my teeth were pulled years ago. So, you know, who knows?
Is he still alive?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's interesting.
His wife's name is Lexi. I've got a picture of their son, Don Norton Jr., who looks, a lot. Well, I can send it to you. I'll let you draw the conclusions. But
okay. Fascinating stuff. Well, we got to take our commercials, but I can say I could talk all day to you, and I know the audience would love hearing you. So thanks, John Armstrong. Thanks for staying over as well, and I hope we get to talk again. I really appreciate it. It's fascinating research. Check it out, everybody. Important work.
Revelation through conversation.
In a time of fake news, fake politicians, and fake fiat currency, it's getting harder to find a genuine article. That's why when it comes to precious metals, I call the team I can trust. This is David Knight from my friends at Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange. Proudly veteran-owned and operated, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange is your home for gold and silver coins, bullion, jewelry, and more. Prices and inventory are updated daily, so you get the most competitive possible pricing. And when it's time to sell your gold and silver items, they pay top dollar. Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange also accepts and deals in Bitcoin. Call or text the owner, Tony Arterburn, today at 888-667-1836. That's 888-667-1836. Or just go to wisewolf.gold. From bullion to Bitcoin, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
What are the dynamics of a crowd? How do you move a mob? How do you excite them? How do you make them feel as one with you?
I don't know how.
Join them first.
Join them?
Yes. When you speak to them as if you were a member of the mob. Speak to them in their language, on their level. Make their hate your hate. If they are poor, talk to them of poverty. If they are afraid, talk to them of their fears. If they are angry, give them objects for their anger. But most of all, the thing that is most of the essence is that you make this mob an extension of yourself. What are the dynamics of a crowd? How do you move a mob? How do you excite? How do you make them feel as one with you?
I don't know how.
Join them first.
Join them?
Yes. When you speak to them as if you were a member of the mob. Speak to them in their language, on their level. Make their hate your hate. If they are poor, talk to them of poverty. If they are afraid, talk to them of their fears. If they are angry, give them objects for their anger. But most of all, for the anger, that is most of all the essence, is that you make this mob an extension of yourself. What are the dynamics of a crowd? How do you move a mob? How do you excite? How do you make them feel as one with you? Join them first.
Join them?
Yes. When you speak to them as if you were a member of the mob. Speak to them in their language, on their level. Make their hate your hate. Talk to them of poverty. Talk to them of their fears. Give them objects for their anger. Make this mob an extension of yourself.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Hi there, this is John Barber, and you're listening to the most informed man in America, my friend, fellow author, and raconteur, the great Donald Jeffries Show.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
GoChili.com.
Now back to Donald Jeffries.
And welcome back to the show. I hope you guys like John Armstrong. He does not give out very many interviews, so this is kind of a special occasion. Again, that website that you can find updated work of his is harveyandlee.net. And we're opening the phone lines now. We don't have as much time left as we normally do, but hopefully we'll get a phone call or two in here. It's 319-527-5016. Again, 319-527-5016. And, of course, we'll get to your questions in the chat room as well. So I was going to, probably go over the, I guess the biggest story in the news is the Afghanistan thing. And I urge all of you, if you don't already, please check out my work on Substack. Substack is a free speech platform. Glenn Greenwald, many other people right there. And they don't censor at all. So it's great to have a platform out there where you can write whatever you want. And those of us with alternative viewpoints can share our perspective. So it's I call it I Protest there, like my other show. And it's DonaldJeffries.substack.com. I hope you'll check out an article I wrote today about that, which is has the clever title, Our Windless Wars Gone Woke, in which I kind of played around with it basically was based on something I saw, and it was The Onion or one of those places that had probably not too far-fetched scenario where the Taliban got a hold of some of the military's diversity training and woke nonsense, and everything was making fun of it and everything. And I think that probably definitely would happen in real life. But, I think what we're seeing is so interesting that however you look at it, and certainly I've written enough about war and peace, however you look at it, most people see, especially most Americans, seem to prefer war to peace. So I think at this point, the left doesn't, what's left of the left, doesn't really know how to handle the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Because, of course, and I think it's ridiculous to blame Joe Biden. I don't think Joe Biden knows where he is, but so I don't think he's responsible for this. I doubt he even knew what happened. But, and I don't know why. As FDR said a long time ago, nothing happens in politics by accident. If it happened, you can bet it was planned that way. So I don't tend to think any of this is by chance. I think that the disaster that happened after they pulled him out, our troops out, happened for a reason. And of course, it makes you wonder what we were there 20 years for. I mean, we were supposedly occupying, and we were watching the opium fields, and but obviously we didn't have much order established there. If the Taliban, which we were supposedly suppressing, if they could take over the country, pretty much the entire country again in a few hours, it seems like, I'm not sure what kind of power we had there in the first place, or if it was, who knows what was going on. But that's why I normally don't pay much attention to foreign policy, because I think it's a distraction, especially our foreign policy. But this is just looking at it from a non-conspiratorial view. This is what happens when you have an absurd foreign policy like ours that is hell-bent on going into other nations and trying to inflict our ideas, our cultural ideas, our ideas of government, our idea of freedom on people that don't have any connection to it at all. I mean, a lot of those Muslims, especially in this country, they have a completely different outlook. They certainly are far more old-fashioned, especially when it comes to women. And they are certainly not going to understand the Heather has two mommies, 57 genders, type of mentality that's overtaken a lot of our culture. So, and this is, but even before that, they weren't going to understand what America was trying to do, because again, we're trying to inflict our notions at the point of rifle point. And, that has never worked. And I think I would urge everyone to look at our foreign policy. And I don't think any good has come out of anything we've done foreign policy wise, certainly since the end of World War II. And DeFed says, do you think they struck a deal with the Taliban to keep the farmers growing pot? Well, they don't tend to give up their drugs. So it's been very lucrative for them. He certainly made tons of money with heroin in Vietnam. And then you had the Contras running, the crack cocaine into the cities that cost Gary Webb his life. So, I doubt very seriously that they're giving that up completely. So, probably so. And again, Taliban, keep in mind, first of all, people don't know history. The Taliban, remember, just like Saddam Hussein, just like Osama bin Laden, who were both CIA creatures. The Taliban was on our side back when Russia was doing this stupid, although they weren't there 20 years. I think they were there about 10 years or so at least. They committed the same, really failed policy in Afghanistan when they went over there and lost, left between with their tail between their legs, just like we did. But at that time, the Taliban were the good guys. They were fighting with us. So it's hard to keep score. And that's why there's so many things. So many parallels between our today's America and Oceania and Orwell's 1984, because, of course, you remember there, Winston Smith and the others in the Ministry of Truth, their job was to constantly rewrite history. And, Oceania has always been at war with Eurasia. No, we've always been at peace with them. And that's pretty much what it is here. So if they would be writing, basically, Saddam Hussein was always bad, Osama bin Laden was always bad, when they were, in fact, our puppets before, and we were actually breeding them, certainly Osama bin Laden. And the same thing with the Taliban. Now the Taliban is are a terrorist, but it's interesting to see with the terrorists that, because this deadly virus seemed to have killed not only the flu, and not only our remaining civil liberties, but it seemed to have killed terrorism. You didn't hear anything about it for quite a while, and now you're actually hearing the traditional terrorists, the Taliban, Hamas and ISIL and ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Can they be far behind? I don't know. They're concentrating on trying to make half of America domestic terrorists. So it'll be interesting to see if they continue to use that word and drop it around so cavalierly like they do racist. With a $1 trillion Big Brother security apparatus, how the hell are there still Taliban in existence? Well, that's, that would be the point. I think we were there for 20 years. But, look at Vietnam. Consider how small Vietnam is, how tiny and backwards they were, especially back then. And I think Oliver Stone has claimed, I assume it's true. I think he's more credible than the mainstream media. He claims that American troops dropped more bombs on Vietnam in our decade or so, or thereabouts there, than all the countries together dropped during World War II, which is hard to believe. But if so, what did the bombing accomplish? But that's American foreign policies in the post-war era, the post-World War II era. It started with the absurd Cold War, which was never really a war, a policy of containment, where we injected troops in countries to stop the spread of communism, and Russia would usually back the troops on the other side, where we didn't fight against each other directly. We had these kind of indirect armies by proxy, and it was just absurd. I mean, you think we would have learned from Korea. You think we'd have learned from Vietnam, but that's because obviously we would have learned if we had people in charge who were attempting to do something rationally and honestly. We obviously don't. Thus why I believe in conspiracies. Taliban were given money from Rumi and Bush administration in March 2001 at the White House. There you go. Yes, thank you. As I've been trying to explain, those fields are not as key as they were. They have been expanded the agro biz there, so it's not centralized anymore. They have sources now in every continent. Yeah, I mean, they're not going to, we know back when General Khun Sa was the head of the Golden Triangle heroin shipping ring that was a press conference held by Bo Greitz. Bo Greitz was the character, the real-life character that they based the Rambo character in all the movies with Sylvester Stallone, and he held a press conference where he talked about General Khun Sa had named his American connection in heroin trading. And he named Richard Armitage, who was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Reagan administration, and probably a Mossad agent. I think he was an Israeli citizen, like so many of these officials have been over the last 40 years. And but just think of that. And the press had no interest. And, you know, they were there. They were all there at the press conference. And that should have been a huge scandal, especially since the press, you know, supposedly hated Reagan. And they were, they're talking about something juicy. Reagan's the Secretary of Secretary of Defense is our man, our connection to the heroin trade, but nothing. And I think Bogreitz, I tried to get him on the show a while back, and I talked to his wife, and she took my number, and he never called me back. So I don't think he gives interviews anymore, but I'd love to talk to him. He was also big in Ruby Ridge. If you include Cambodia, it's more than World War II, yeah. That's right, yep. Remember back in 2001 when Cheney said war on terror would last for 100 years? Well, you know, it looked like it had been killed by this virus, unless you want to include the domestic terrorists, because they're, you know, again. But I had remarked on this that constant endless wars, and when they finally withdrew from Afghanistan, I said, well, maybe they're going to switch gears here now. Maybe they're off the wars of racket that Smedley Butler talked about back after World War I. But no, I guess they can't give it up because they've had us so distracted. Because basically, right now, America is basically at war with its government and has been to varying degrees, certainly since 9/11. And so, you know, when you have a situation of if H.R. 350 passes, and it probably will, and Congress, that bill is going to create a domestic terrorism department in both the FBI and the Justice Department. Now, it doesn't matter who they're going to qualify as domestic terrorists. We know at this point, because the woke party's in charge, we know basically who they're going to call domestic terrorists. I mean, people like me and podcasters like that are in danger of being called domestic terrorists. But, I would feel just the same if it was, BLM or Antifa or whatever. I mean, this is, you can't do something like that because that demonizes political belief. It kills what's left of civil liberties. But it's probably going to pass unless there's a groundswell of opposition to it. And I haven't seen anybody except maybe Ron Paul in the public eye that's spoken out against it. And they may try to surreptitiously pass that when they we get distracted by things like this. And it could be that's what this is, a distraction for that, or maybe even something else. Then Cheney went hunting naked, brainwashed women on a private compound with one of the Supreme Court judges. Well, you know, I had her on my other show, Kathy O'Brien, and that's what she said. It basically played the most dangerous game, if you've seen that movie. And it's amazing to think that. Oh, we have a caller on the line. Caller, are you there?
Yes. Hello, this is Jimmy James.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. What's on your mind?
I've just been listening. Good show with Mr. Armstrong there.
Yeah.
Especially the last part about that Don Norton. That's really interesting.
That's amazing. He's still alive, too. Boy, I'd love to be able to track him down. Yeah, that's I've seen pictures of him. I don't know. Maybe it's hard to tell, of course. You know, you don't know. Last we saw of any Lee Harvey Oswald was officially, it was obviously in November 24th, 1963. So who knows how he would have aged, you know?
Yeah.
So a question for you, and there are you, is this Jimmy James from News Radio? Somebody in the chat room asks?
Yes, it is. Billionaire. Just calling in. Check out things.
Well, that's cool. You have a fan in the chat room, so that's cool.
I was wondering, what do you think about Leon Panetta coming out and saying that this was quote unquote Joe Biden's Bay of Pigs? I mean, is the war hawk side of the left turning on old Joe there?
Well, you know, it looks like, again, I don't make any predictions. Ever since Trump was elected in 2016, never saw that coming. I said I gave up political predictions because I used to be able to predict what these guys are going to do a little easier. But I don't know what this – it looks – I mean, if I was to guess, it looks like maybe they're greasing the skids to try to get Biden out of there. Maybe they're finally going to claim he has dementia and notice what a lot with all these opponents notice. Maybe Saturday Night Live will finally discover the comedic gold in Joe Biden. Now they can, you know, they can get somebody to impersonate him. I mean, I think it'd be at least as funny as their Trump skits. But I don't know. And maybe the late night comedians on the alleged comedians on the talk shows will start making fun of him. I think, but if that's the case, they may be using that, as we've all suspected, that he was maybe just a temporary puppet there until they can get Kamala Harris in, who would be, more with their mental faculties there, but would obviously follow orders. I don't think Kamala Harris has any principles at all. So I think she'd be a perfect puppet for the elite, because I don't think she's averse to doing anything. It's hard to tell where she – I mean, of course, she's playing the woke game now, but – she was really a hard ass as the California Attorney General, and she had some awful policies out there that were terrible to prisoners. So we'll see. I don't know. I mean, right now I'd probably prefer President presidency to Harris.
Well, she would face, I would think, an immediate obstacle, because neither of her parents were natural-born Americans. So right there, someone right off the bat's going to challenge that in the Supreme Court, because she doesn't meet the constitutional requirements to be president.
Yeah, well, we kind of went through that with Obama, and I think especially if it's someone.
No.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the stuff about Obama was speculative. I mean, it's an established fact that neither of her parents were natural born citizens.
Right, but isn't it?
So this is something that.
Yeah, as I understand it, if the person is born, so if she was born in America, I think that would be all that counts. Because they would definitely mention the Obama controversy and say, you know, see, the only two black presidents we've ever had, and people are talking about where were they born? How come that didn't happen anymore any other time? But I would imagine that's what they'd say. But I don't know, man.
There's no question she was born here, but in order to qualify, both her parents would have to have been natural born citizens.
Yeah.
That's my understanding.
Okay. Yeah, it says, I've heard this thing about the parents not to be born in America thing before too. Not sure about that. I don't know. As I understand it, the Constitution says you have to be born, but who knows? If that's true, then obviously that's that would be something to look into. But
this idea that, you know, being born within the confines of America makes you a citizen, that's not particularly legal or true either.
Well, and that's why. That's why, you know, I think that one of the things that was, the many disappointments about Donald Trump was that failure to end birthright citizenship the first year. Because regardless how you think of it, I mean, that provides really, great fodder for people to abuse that. You can just come here and get, as long as you have your baby here. And we see that all the time, obviously, that it's a citizen and you can get all these benefits you couldn't get otherwise. And again, I don't think we need to be doing that. If we ever needed it, we certainly don't need it anymore. But that's another story. I know I'm tilting at windmills there. Anything else on your mind?
Oh, I guess that's it. Great show. It was good talking to you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you calling. Appreciate you listening, Jimmy. Thanks so much.
Yep. Bye.
Take care. Okay. We got, I was basically just chatting going on in the chat room. So it will be interesting to see how this spins as far as will it be. Because what I'm hearing, and again, it's somebody who is, on the far left for most of my life, and I still think I am. It's just not this left. This left is just, crazy. So I can't stand with them. They don't want me there, that's for sure. But obviously, I've always been against all war. I'm anti-war. I'm constantly trying to promote peace as much as I can. But I'm seeing more and more, you know, it's the Tucker Carlson's, Dan Bongino. I mean, I'm hearing they're the ones that are talking about what a disaster the 20 years in Afghanistan was, how pointless it was. We have to stop nation building. I don't see that from the left, except people like, you know, my friend Naomi Wolf and of course, my friend Cindy Sheehan, Cynthia McKinney. I don't hear it from anybody else on the left. I do not hear any, certainly not going to hear that from Nancy Pelosi or anybody like that, or Rachel Maddow, or the comparables to Tucker Carlson on MSNBC or CNN or whatever. You're just not going to hear that. And it's, I think that started with Pat Buchanan, who I still say Pat Buchanan was the most consistent anti-war activist of the last 40 years. And again, he's from the far right. And I don't know why that is, when that changed, but the left. So it'll be interesting to see, because basically the criticism of our leaving, it is obviously going to Biden in some degree. And of course, some are blaming Trump, but, you know, that's what happens. And, you know, they're blaming Biden. Some are blaming Obama, you know, because we were there 20 years. You can blame Bush, but and some are. But the inference there is that we have to go back. That, you know, see, we pulled out and, you know, again, 20 years, what did we accomplish there? And at some point you have to cut your losses and go, and hopefully, again, if there's no conspiracy, you learn your lesson. But just, I was driving around today, and I don't even know who it was, but it was some administration official, and it was the same stupid mantra I've heard since 9/11 and before, how we have to, you know, we have to encounter, we have to face terrorism wherever we can. I think Biden said it too. And it's just, you know, you just showed what a disaster your horrible foreign policy is. You got people nonsensically clinging onto airplanes as they're flying off. I mean, I don't even understand that. That's, I was almost thinking that's got to be CGI. People really do that? I don't know. But clearly, whatever you were doing in Afghanistan didn't work. And you accomplished nothing. Everything fell apart as soon as you left. So is the answer just to stay there forever and accomplish nothing? But that's, you know, that's, and they're going to, you know, they want to make the same mistake again. They'll be ready to plunge into the next country where they demonize someone as what H.L. Mencken called a hobgoblins, and commit our boys to go, and girls now, to go over there and give up their lives to stop them from doing whatever they're doing. Ed DeFed says they could pull a JFK and set up some right winger as a patsy, get rid of Sleepy Joe, and whip up anti-white hysteria all at once. Well, you know, again, I don't make predictions, but that certainly would fit their agenda. They'd certainly open up the domestic terrorist can of worms there. Let's see. Okay, there's just people just chatting. I don't see, but. So, you know, it's, at what point do the American people start to band better? But I mean, I might as well be saying that. How often is that? I mean, I'm looking at, I don't have much hope ever. And people tell me all the time, I'm too pessimistic. And I am. I'm very cynical. I'm a fan of Ambrose Bierce, after all. But it's hard to find any optimism looking around at the country or the world today. But I do feel that these parents at the school boards, and especially Loudoun County, which is, you know, that's where it's all coming from. That's like the Lexington and Concord for this, my neighboring county where I used to work. And it's, I'm seeing some really good things there. I'm seeing parents that are fed up and mad as hell and not going to take it anymore, to quote Network. Until he says Kamala is a better device to frame right wingers with. Yeah, probably so. Yeah. So you assassinated the first black woman president. I don't know. Yeah. There's certainly they can do whatever they want at this point, because they're going to frame things as they want to frame it. And of course, you're seeing all the memes out there with the Michael Moore and all the other, again, what's left of the left, you know, comparing the ridiculous so-called insurrectionists with the Taliban, our Taliban, their Taliban. It's just, you know, it's absolutely ridiculous. Why don't they have a picture of the CIA or the FBI or something that has actually really wreaked havoc against the people? But so if you look at what we're seeing in the school board meetings, You are seeing this is, I think, the only possible change that can happen is at that level. And if again, I've got some hopium here. You know, I've got a lot, not hopium, it's hope. But if they can't start forcing some of these school board members, these incredibly arrogant, and again, the level, this is how bad and how rotten and corrupt the system is from top to bottom, because this is pretty much the bottom. So if you can't effect change, if you can't make them responsive to the will of the people at that level, you're certainly never going to get Congress or the president or the Supreme Court ever to do it. But if you can start making, if you can start recalling some of those school board members, if you can get them to resign in disgrace for the corrupt buffoons that they are, and the little tyrant wannabes, if you can do that, then and start actually getting some sensible, honest people on the school boards. I mean, that's a given. You can't just keep replacing them with the same type of horrible, corruptible people. But if you can do that, then the tiny ripples of hope I talk about, you may start to see that, and maybe they'll cascade up, or we'll deal with the. Okay, we got another caller. Good. Caller, you're on the line.
Hey, Don, it's Chris. How you doing?
Hey, Chris, how's it going?
It's going all right. I just had two questions for you.
Sure.
I had asked earlier, just because I didn't know if the gentleman had any information about the Thomas Arthur Valley part.
Yeah, yeah.
My question is, all the years of research that you did with the JFK stuff, did you ever come across any kind of program that had like a similar like body double for Valley, like with the Oswald situation, or even come across, you know, who the designated patsy may have been for the Miami possible hit? That's what I was always wondering, if you came across. I know you don't like to speculate, and that's good, but I didn't know if you had an opinion maybe about that.
Well, no, I've never heard that specifically, but I think that John Armstrong's theory was probably, I mean, I don't, you know, I didn't get to ask him, but I think that he may have, he probably started his research, I would guess, when just he looked at all of the, you know, undeniable Oswald sightings that couldn't have been Oswald, the Oswald impersonations that were happening with Sylvia Odio and Albert Bogard. And Ralph Yates, people like that, that were happening, you know, in the immediate period before the assassination, who've all been demonized, even by what I call neocon people in the alleged research community. But so I think it was, you know, kind of a logical extension to build on that is like, you know, if you know this was going on, and then Jack White, who doesn't get the credit he deserves, he's the first one that really started analyzing the photos, and it's undeniable that Oswald looks different in a lot of the photos.
I noticed that he got a lot of crap too in those JFK forum.
Oh yeah, gosh, he
forums too.
I still, he's been gone for, you know, like almost 10 years or whatever, but he I still defend him from time to time when crazy people still attack him, and he did a lot of good work that went under. I know he helped John Armstrong a lot, and but you know, these are the people that were talking about, hey, this is, you know, the discrepancies in his height, the discrepancies in, you know, with his chin, and, you know, just basic things like that. I mean, one of them had a bull neck. You know, Lee had a bull neck and Harvey didn't. Things that don't change.
Like Al Bundy.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, you know, it's basically, it's hard not to question that. Now, I you know, I love John's work, and I've already told him I don't necessarily accept all his theory, but you know, that's okay. He has discovered some incredible information, and that can't be explained in the record. So, you know, it's up for, you know, people can try to explain it however they want. But it's, you know, when you have things like his school records and Frank Kudlady and the FBI coming and getting Oswald's school records when he was apparently at two high schools at once, two schools at one time. And, you know, there's – go ahead.
No, I was just laughing. I agree with you. Yeah, I was just, it crossed my mind. Do you think that there could be programs that are still like in place where they kind of groom some of these patsy-like figures, like from birth, that type of thing, or is that too far-fetched? Because I heard similar theories about like McVeigh and Ada and all that too. So I don't know if I buy into it, but
no, I don't. Well, I don't know either, but you can even look at, you know, so you send me so much information, but if you look at some of these other guys, these lead shooters, mass casualty, I mean, you look in their backgrounds and there's strange things there all the time. So, yeah, I mean, we know the work of Cameron and Gottlieb with the CIA back in the 50s. Yep. We know what they were doing. So is it that much of a stretch to think that, I mean, and, you know, most of us in this world believe that there are child sex trafficking rings. And you mentioned in the chat room how, you know, you have Dick Cheney going after Kathy O'Brien and people like little kids and playing the most dangerous game with them. So if they're doing that and, you know, they're adrenochrome, all these other things, why would they be averse to, you know, finding, and I imagine they would get kids for something like that from the same kind of backgrounds that child sex abuse victims come from, where there's a background where they can exploit them, they can get them there, they have a broken homes or whatever. So it wouldn't surprise me. And I know people, you know, I'm aware of the criticism. Well, how do you know they're going to grow up to look the same and stuff? Like, I don't know. The record is what it is. He was apparently registered for school in a couple different places at the same time. The weight and height's different. And if you look at the recollections of I've actually read Harvey and Lee. And if you look at the recollections of his neighbors and teachers, they remember totally different things about Lee and Harvey. Like, there are two kids, and they remember totally different things about the mothers as well. It's hard to explain that, too. And, of course, that opens up a whole new can of worms. But it is what it is. I mean, the tall, good-looking Marguerite is not the woman that we saw after the assassination, who really was the first conspiracy theorist. So there's a lot to explain there. But, you know, the Kennedy assassination is a – is a can of worms into itself, but it's never ceases to amaze me.
Well, before I let you go, I guess one way they could try to estimate what the person would probably look like is probably no different than what they use, what police use to kind of show you what the person that disappeared, what they may look like 10 years later, that type of thing.
Right, right.
That's the only thing I could think of, but... Yeah. A great show, Don.
Well, thanks, Chris. Thanks for all your help.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Bye-bye. Yeah, you too. Thanks. That's Chris, who is my number one researcher. He sends me so much information. It's amazing. So he's going to be at the top of the acknowledgments list. I have lots of other people, too. Bob Wilson, Peter Seacosh, that send me lots of research as well. So I appreciate them. And I see it looks like Jacob's in the chat room too. Yes, always you're a very loyal supporter as well. I appreciate you guys being over here and get more people over. So it's nice to have an active chat room. Does he cover the Alec Heidel? And, you know, that's I'm trying to remember about that. Maybe Chuck, if he's read it, knows. I don't recall how much he talked about that in Harvey and Lee. That's a good question. But that's certainly I've been looking at a lot of that testimony. You know, there was a guy named Heindel, John Rene Heindel, I think it was, in the Marines, who a lot of people said his name was, you know, was referred to as Heidel. And is that somehow related to Oswald? I don't know. You know, the Heidel alias is something that needs to be looked at more. But I remember when I first, you know, learned that real Selective Service cards don't have photographs on them. And Alec Heidel's Selective Service card with a picture of Lee Harvey Oswald on it, you know, it did have one. That told me, okay, you know, what if that's not a setup, what is it? Because if you're gonna have a form of identity, you're not gonna have a picture on it when real Selective Service cards don't, unless you want to immediately have people know it's a forgery. So the only reason for something like that would be to try to associate the Heidel name with the image of Oswald, and that's obviously, to try to frame him for something. And so anyway, we're winding down here. So again, I hope you guys enjoyed it. It ended up being more, but that's John's a wonderful guy, but he preferred to present that way. So it was pretty much like listening to one of his conference presentations, and he did take some questions afterwards, and hopefully I can get him back and we'll talk about, back about more, aspects of it, because we could have probably 50 shows on it, because there's so many aspects of it. We could do one on Heidel, you know, and something like that. I wish I could remember exactly what he wrote about in Harvey and Lee. I'm not sure if he addresses that or not, because again, he has his own theory. I don't necessarily share the whole theory, but anyhow, so this was a great show, and I appreciate all the chat room, appreciate the calls, and I hope you listen Next week, I have Dr. Roger Hodgkinson, who's a really hot topic with the plandemic. He's scheduled to be the guest, so hopefully be on. So as always, thanks so much for listening to the Donald Jeffrey Show. Keep on sending those tiny ripples of hope.